May it please the court, counsel. I'm William Lapson, registration number 4897, and I represent Brad Calkins, George Calkins, Bradley Petroleum, and Save-A-Mat. They're the four defendants in this case. They're the appellants in this case. I prefer, unless the court disagrees, to refer to them as the defendants of the posture that they were at the trial court level. A major part of our appellate argument in this case consists of the fact that there are no actual real plaintiffs or claimants in this case. Nevertheless, in order to preserve the fiction that there is another side to this case, we'll all refer to them as the plaintiffs in this case unless the court feels otherwise. Rule 34C makes it mandatory that I include in my opening argument a concise statement of the case. This case was started in 2001 by one plaintiff, Mrs. Akimoto, who sued Bradley seeking repayment of certain deductions that had been taken by Bradley from her wages. The case was settled in 2003, and between 2001 and 2003, an additional 25 plaintiffs were added to the action. While the case was never certified as a class action, at the time of settlement, the trial court certified it as a class action for the limited purpose of settlement only, so that not only the 25 plaintiffs, but other people similarly situated would get the relief that was called for by the settlement agreement. Within a year of 2003, all 25 plaintiffs, as well as similarly situated plaintiffs, were paid whatever they were called for under whatever they're entitled to under the settlement agreement. The settlement agreement, like 99.9% of all settlement agreements, called for dismissal of the case once everybody had been paid, called for release of all claims. Despite that commitment in the settlement agreement, the case is still ongoing as of today. And it has been our continued objection that the court should not exercise jurisdiction in this case.
Pardon me for interrupting you, Mr. Rapson, if I may, please. But would you be so kind as to address what I would suggest is the principal argument from the other side, that there is language in the agreement that says we're going to continue this case to make sure that these issues remain resolved?
Well, I think what the language is, and I'd have to get the specific language, but it's what the central issue in this case, at least in part. I mean, our second argument is, regardless of anything else, you cannot go forward with a case without plaintiffs, without claimants, without people pay filing fees, without a judicial process. But setting that aside, the issue is the language in the settlement agreement gives the court continuing jurisdiction to hear future claims. The issue then becomes, does the future claims mean claims 50 years later, or 100 years later, or 30 years later, or does it refer to the people that they're trying to find and locate, the similarly situated plaintiffs? In other words, the first 25, it's clear what their claims are, but we know that there's a group of people who are also entitled to relief under the terms of the settlement agreement, and some of those people, there could be some claims, future claims regarding whether they're entitled to $200 or $100 or $300, and the court's got to be able to have jurisdiction to resolve those claims. And that's why that language is in there. If it had been intended that future claims referred to claims 10 years later, in other words, in 2011, or 20 years from now, there would be some language, something in that agreement that would intimate, suggest, expressly state that kind of a concept, because it's such a bizarre concept to say to a court, you're going to sit here for the rest of your life and into the next millennium to decide future claims. It's such a unique thing that there has got to be some kind of language that would suggest that would support it. The mere use of future claims has to be taken in the context of what they were doing at the time. And
pardon me, Mr. Rapson, I recognize your argument, but aren't there certain situations where you've got a problem with, say, an employer or state government, and you're concerned about it continuing, and you'd want to be sure that the court continues to have jurisdiction to make sure this problem doesn't reoccur? If that's the case, wouldn't that be one reason to leave this open-ended?
Well, I think that there may be situations like that, but if you look at the context of this case and the things we point out on pages 23 to 26 of our opening brief, that was not the situation. The what plaintiff's counsel put on the record for the court was that the reason for the settlement was to time ball this case, was to get this case over with, was to resolve everything, to go on about business. It was not to leave it open for future claims brought by unknown people under unknown circumstances into the future.
Mr. Rapson, but isn't that exactly what the parties did here? I mean, they're saying the court shall retain continuing jurisdiction over this action for purposes of hearing future claims. Why shouldn't we give effect to that language?
Because future claims involves the claims of these similarly situated people. They were having to go out at that time and find these people. They were not part of the 25 groups, so they had to go out and find them. And they didn't know whether their claims would be $100 or $200. They didn't know whether everybody would agree on whether it was $100 or $200. So the court had to retain jurisdiction to decide, do they get $100, $200, or $150? If the court had ever, if the settlement agreement had anticipated that this case would still be going on 10, 20, 30, 40 years ago, there'd have to be some language that would support that. Something that would suggest that in the year, in 2100, the court could still be looking at these issues. And there's nothing that begins to support that kind of a situation.
What assurance do we have in the record that none of either the original 26 plaintiffs or the class of plaintiffs that was part of the settling class, what assurance do we have that none of them are still employees and none of them are still aggrieved?
Well, everybody got paid. There's nothing in the record, nothing, nada, that even begins to suggest that anybody as part of that original group still has a claim. Nothing. If they do have a claim, they haven't been heard, and that's the obligation of a plaintiff, is to be heard. You cannot sit on a claim, keep it in your pocket, and never talk about it, never bring it to the attention of the court. And what Your Honor is opening the door for me is with respect to the second argument. There's nothing in the record, nothing, that even begins to suggest that there is a current plaintiff in the case, a current claimant in the case, a current claim in the case, a filing fee that's ever been paid. There is nothing in the case that begins to resemble what an ordinary civil case looks like, where you have two parties, there are rules that apply, you have a way of processing claims. This case is like a regulatory agency where the court is acting as a regulatory agency or is acting as a private attorney general. It's not anything like what a normal civil case
is. Do you concede that if there are individuals that are still being docked their pay inappropriately, that those individuals are not precluded by the settlement agreement from coming forward?
I think anybody who wants to, who has a claim, and it happens every day, not every day, there are maybe two claims that I'm aware of right now, but people go to the Colorado Department of Labor and they have their claims resolved through them. They go to federal regulatory agencies, they bring civil actions, and they, of course, could, if they wanted to, bring a new class action or whatever that's not subject to the settlement agreement that says this case is to be dismissed. There are a lot of options that anybody who's aggrieved has.
And Mr. Rapson, pardon me for interrupting, but I certainly understand that point, that there are a lot of options. But the issue, I think, here is that there appears to have been a repeated course of conduct that led to the resolution in this case. And if there is a repeated course of conduct, and I'm going back to the question I was asking earlier, doesn't it make sense, in order to make sure that this employer doesn't continue doing this, that this case remain open so that there can be some enforcement mechanism immediately without requiring new plaintiffs to open new cases to start new balls rolling?
Well, Your Honor, there isn't a repeated course of conduct. I know Mr. Christensen will take issue. It's an evolving kind of thing. And the best example I can give you is the main problem back in 2003 and thereafter was this cash shortages, which they, if there wasn't a good explanation for cash shortages, they deducted it from the wages of employees. In 2009, they scrapped that plan and they said, if you don't have a good explanation for cash loss, we're going to fire you. And when that happened, 90% of the cash shortages dropped. and it confirmed the suspicion of Bradley that basically these cash shortages were just interim loans that the employees were making to themselves because they knew that they were going to have to pay it back come time when they got paid. What happened here, and we're not taking issue with the substantive rulings of the court, we think that they're wrong, but the court said all cash shortages have to be reimbursed, regardless of the circumstances. Now, what about the circumstance where it's a purposeful cash borrowing? To require that payment to be made to that person is double dipping. But because this court is using a broad brush as a regulatory agency, there are no individual claims. There's no process to consider the fact that this is a double dipping situation because the court just says pay everybody, you know, like a regulatory agency, and that's wrong. I'd like to reserve whatever amount I have left.
Certainly, sir. You've got 4 minutes and about 10 seconds.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
May it please the court, counsel. My name is Lee Christian, 18743. I'm here with Gerald Kilmer. I am here also with Shireen Anderson, who was a former Bradley Petroleum employee who scraped together some gas money to get here today. She testified in the hearing below about what happened to her and how she wasn't borrowing money and how she is still interested in this case and the result.
So is she among the 26 named claimants in the case?
No, she is not.
Is she a member of the settlement class?
She is not.
Is she in the case?
Judge, she is in the case because of the settlement agreement back in 2003. The settlement agreement was very clear, and the individuals who were plaintiffs in that case were very clear in settling that case, only if there was going to be a future deterrence of the...
How can you represent someone back in 03 that doesn't come forward until 07?
Due to the contract between the parties, Judge, the settlement agreement between the settling plaintiffs and Bradley Petroleum and the individual defendants was put in place not only to resolve the claims of all of those individuals from 2003 and before, but to stop Bradley Petroleum from doing what it has been doing for approximately 30 years now.
At the function of the Colorado Department of Labor?
The Colorado Department of Labor does not have the authority to bring lawsuits, and it doesn't. And that is also part of the reason for that agreement.
Why do you say they don't have the authority to bring lawsuits? How do they enforce their rules?
They don't, Judge. That's why Bradley Petroleum...
They don't is one question. Do they have the authority to do it?
Judge, they do not have the authority to, or haven't, brought any case, despite thousands of claims that have been filed with them regarding Bradley Petroleum and Savomat. And as an aside, Mr. Rapson said that he is aware of two claims that currently exist. In contacting the Colorado Department of Labor yesterday, since the September ruling by Judge McGahee in 2009, there have been another 36 claims that have been filed with the Colorado Department of Labor, which in my experience is just the tip of the iceberg. That means there's probably hundreds of people who have been wronged.
I understand that you don't think very highly of the business practices of Bradley, but the question that occurs to me is, who is pursuing this case today? By what authority do you represent people who are not even named in this case? How can that confer jurisdiction on the trial court for you to pursue a claim against people who are not identified in any way?
Well, just they are. I disagree with the court. They are identifiable, and they're identifiable through a
identifiable. You say, are they identified? Can this company know who your clients are based on the pleadings in this case?
I'm sure that this defendant is aware of the individuals who have been aggrieved by their actions, and this is not an uncommon practice, Your Honor, for a agreement to be put in place to try to enforce important public policy and societal items.
But ordinarily done in a class action case?
It is done in a class action
case. Is there a class certification in this case?
The class was certified for the purposes of the settlement and the settlement agreement.
Which brings me back to my point again. Who do you represent?
Judge,
unnamed people?
Judge, I represent not only the previous plaintiffs, who have a claim in enforcing this agreement, and specifically signed affidavits stating that they were agreeing to settle this case only under the circumstances that Bradley Petroleum be supervised by continuing court jurisdiction. So, in essence, I do represent the prior plaintiffs in their claims and agreements.
They're presently directing you in this case?
Excuse me?
Are the named 26 plaintiffs directing you in this case?
I don't know what you mean by directing, Your Honor, but I certainly...
Well, the way a client directs his lawyer.
Well, I keep in touch with Ms. Okamoto. She follows this case because she is still interested in getting Bradley Petroleum and saving that to follow the law. To the extent that she is directing me, or that I am taking direction from her, I would say that's not the case. Judge, there is a...
Who are you taking your direction from as a lawyer? Who are you engaged by right now to represent this claim?
I have no fee agreements with any individuals, Your Honor.
So this is just your attempt to correct this problem that you see with Bradley Petroleum?
Not that I see, Judge. I think many prior government entities, many prior private attorneys general, attorneys generals have tried to stop Bradley Petroleum. No one has been successful. I've devoted half of my career to try to getting them to follow the law. And the law permits private attorney generals and encourages private attorney generals to try to right wrongs.
Had issue ever raised in functioning as a private attorney?
Well, yes, I think it was. I mean, I think I've always told Judge McGahee and others the reason for my going forward, and that is to enforce the terms of the settlement agreement, which are in place to try to get someone, some court, some power that be, to stop Bradley Petroleum from taking small amounts of money from thousands of individuals that total tens, if not hundreds of thousands of dollars.
Why didn't you bring action then and try to certify this class?
I didn't think that I needed to, Your Honor. I thought the settlement agreement was very clear, that the authority of a judge who has already had the court case in place to supervise Bradley Petroleum to make them follow the law. Bradley Petroleum has been persistent, protracted. These violations of the law have been voluminous. They have been willful. And the court was misled for many years as to what was going on with Bradley Petroleum. Bradley Petroleum had always said after 2004 that there were only a few individuals and only some, and these were just mistakes. Well, we learned that that wasn't the case, and we learned that there was actually thousands of the same sorts of things.
Pardon me for interrupting you, Mr. Christian, if
yes,
I may, please. I guess my question goes back to the agreement itself. I asked counsel about the language that I believe you rely upon. I want to ask you about the language that counsel for your opponent relies on. And that is the language that apparently says this is going to be over now. It says this case is going to be dismissed once everybody's paid. And while, I mean, conceptually, I can see your point, I'm wondering whether the precise language of this agreement doesn't undercut it. That had you drafted an agreement that says this case will remain open, and the purpose of it remaining open is to enforce this against Bradley Petroleum for future employees, we'd have a clear statement in the agreement that was the intent. But now we've got a problem, and we have to look at this thing as a whole. And looking at it as a whole, it says once these people get paid, the 26 folks, this case is going to be dismissed. Would you address that, please?
Thank you, Judge Barron. Note that Mr. Rapson doesn't finish the sentence, and the agreement says, and the court found and signed a court order saying that the claims of the current plaintiffs would be dismissed, and the case would be dismissed as to them, with continuing jurisdiction remaining for the court to supervise Bradley Petroleum to make sure they follow the law. That's very specifically in the agreement. That's very specifically what the court found. That was very specifically what was put on the record at a hearing prior to the signing of the agreement, and that's certainly what the affidavits of the plaintiffs at the time said, that this was not the end of the case, that it may be the end of the case as far as they were being paid, but it wasn't the end of the case as far as someone having continuing jurisdiction over a historical a violator of Colorado wage law, which is a very important part of the public policy of the state, is that people get paid their wages. We aren't dealing with people who can go and file suits, and they don't have the time, they don't have the money, they're afraid of the system. Someone and some entity, and hopefully this court, needs to do something in order to stop Bradley Petroleum from doing what they were doing. And that was clearly the intent of the agreement, and that was clearly the intent of the parties. And it was clearly the intent of the defendants as well. They went years after the settlement agreement trying to follow the law. They never have objected to jurisdiction until they got caught with over 1,000 violations of the law. They waived this jurisdiction argument.
Pardon me, counsel. If it is truly a jurisdictional argument, it can be raised at any time. And I must respectfully disagree with your statement that jurisdictional arguments are waived. They can raise it now. Now, whether it's effective or not is an entirely different issue, but I think they can raise it now.
I think there is law, Judge, and it is cited in my brief that there is the concepts of waiver and implied consent do apply to jurisdictional issues. And I think that's clearly what happened in the years prior to Judge McGahee's ruling in late 2009. And that is they agreed to the jurisdiction of the court for a long time until they found out that it could cost them tens of thousands of dollars. And so I do believe that waiver could apply, and I believe there is law to that end.
So are you suggesting that parties can confer jurisdiction on the court even though the law provides no jurisdiction?
Well, I think the law does provide jurisdiction.
For unnamed plaintiffs?
The law does provide jurisdiction for remedies of wage violations by a Colorado defendant. And yes, there can be...
Doesn't that require someone to bring that action?
Someone has brought that action.
Does Ms. Okamoto have authority to bring a claim on behalf of the lady that you brought with you today?
Your Honor, if this was a separate lawsuit, Ms. Okamoto could not bring the claim for Ms. Anderson. But because the parties agreed to confer jurisdiction and the court agreed to take jurisdiction, noting the problems that had been raised in the past, that is why the case is continuing forward, is the agreement to try to remedy a longstanding public ill, to have the court have jurisdiction over future claims, if any, to get Bradley Petroleum to follow the law. And I think that is the huge issue here, is whether this is a valid agreement to get Bradley Petroleum to follow the law.
So I must disagree. Issue here is whether there was jurisdiction in the court to decide this. You may have a wonderful claim and a great argument, but you can't pursue it in this case if there is no jurisdiction. No one is suggesting that Bradley shouldn't be required to follow the law, but the question is, does your client, and I'm not sure who that is at this point, have jurisdiction to pursue this claim, and did the court have jurisdiction to adjudicate it? That's the question, not the conduct of Bradley. That remains to be adjudicated as far as these future claims are concerned. The question is there jurisdiction in the court, and is there someone bringing this lawsuit who has a claim?
Judge, there is precedent for courts to have continuing jurisdiction to enforce the settlement agreement, to enforce settlement agreements between the parties in order to supervise and enforce the law. It happens all the time, and that's what has occurred in this case as well, is the parties agreed to consent to jurisdiction of a court to make sure that wage violations didn't continue, and there's no reason that can't occur. The court can have a continuing jurisdiction into the future to try to right wrongs, and it makes sense too, especially in a case like this.
No plaintiff.
No actual plaintiff, but there are certainly persons who are aggrieved.
Counsel, there are remedies for them. You can file a new lawsuit for them. The fact that there are problems in the future doesn't confer jurisdiction on the court nor any authority on your clients to pursue claims for people they don't even know.
Well, and I respectfully disagree, Your Honor. I do not believe that persons who are financially unable and unwilling to file a claim for $30 to $100 should be forced to do so when the law provides a remedy that is in place. And
other remedy is called a class action lawsuit.
And that is how we got here to today, Your Honor.
But you don't have a class certified.
Judge, there is no class. This is not a continuing class action. It's a continuing case of the court having continuing jurisdiction to try to enforce the law and to remedy future claims. There is also a claim for attorney's fees in this case under two theories. The Colorado Wage Act is a very important act. It is there in place to encourage individuals, attorneys, solo practitioners to enforce the law.
Mr. Christian, but didn't the agreement itself address that issue? I mean, it's provided that a specific amount was going to be paid to the attorneys, and you were paid that amount, correct?
And the clear intent of the agreement as well, Your Honor, was that that was to cover the payment of those individuals who had been aggrieved in 2003 and before, not in the future. And that was the clear intent of the agreement.
Thank you, Mr. Christian. Your
Thank
time,
Your Honors.
For Rapson, you got 4 minutes and 7 seconds.
Thank you, Your Honor. Mike, please, the court counsel. There was no clear intent that there be additional attorney's fees. The settlement agreement that in the court ruled on this a number of different times is expressly forbids any further request in this case for attorney's fees. It's flat, black and white. It admits of no exception. It admits of no kind of way to worm around the language or anything. It's just black and white, and the court several times did that. Even if the language had been somewhat wishy-washy, which it is not, the applicable statute 84105 only applies where three things exist. There has to be a prevailing party. There is no party. That prevailing party has to have paid attorney's fees. No prevailing party has paid attorney's fees. And the defendants have to have acted without good faith. And there are several instances that I cite in the briefs where the court said that the defendants acted in good faith. Now, you listen to Mr. Christian in his demonizing of Bradley, and it almost makes it appear as if there isn't any good faith here. Well, the court found good faith, and the reality is that there are a lot of issues here that you can argue both ways. We've got a current issue before the Department of Labor right now that you could look at either way. Bradley takes a position that where they pay minimum wage and where they have on videotape somebody stealing money from the cash drawer, that they can count the money stolen towards minimum wage. The Department of Labor says, no, you always have to pay minimum wage no matter what. And we say, not where we can show that there's been a theft and the money's gone in the pocket. That money is treated, as far as we're concerned, as minimum wage. That issue hasn't been litigated. It should be litigated one of these days, but it's a legitimate issue. The same thing with these cash shortages. In all instances, the statute says that you can make the deduction from the wages if you get the consent of the employee. And so Bradley went to the employees and got their consent where they had no good explanation for the cash shortage.
How do you have consent when, you know, the employee's being threatened with being fired? Like, you either sign or you're fired.
This is before that. This new 2009 program is one where if there isn't a good explanation, you're out of there. I mean, you're just, and that's what caused a 90% drop in the cash shortages. And that's what caused Bradley to think that those previous cash shortages were just borrowings. Person takes some money, they know that Bradley's going to come back and say, will you agree to let us deduct this from your salary? And they give them a form and they sign it, and everybody's happy. Bradley's acting as a interim bank. But all these issues have a legitimacy on both sides. You can come out on one side or the other as a judge on these issues, but they're all legitimate issues. They're not the kind of issues suggested otherwise. final comment is back again. There's been, as counsel did acknowledge, there is no plaintiff in this case. There's nothing in the record to suggest any plaintiff, any claimant, any claim, any payment of a filing fee. There's been no due process resolution of claims. We haven't been able to say to the court, you know, this is a double dipping situation. So here, where there's been a cash shortage, we shouldn't have to pay this person. It's across the board. You got to pay everybody. And again, our concern goes to the jurisdiction and not to the substantive merits. But in terms of substantive merits, it's not a black and white kind of situation, Your Honors. Thank you very much.
Thank you, counsel. And thank both sides for your oral arguments today. We appreciate them very much. The issue will stand, the case will stand submitted, and an opinion will issue in due course.